Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast where I, your host, Scott McNulty, talk about a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My non-random guest tonight is Mike Cole. Mike, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
It is a pleasure. Tell the people a little bit about yourself. How might they know you?
They would only probably know me for one way, and that's as a fantasy novelist. My military fantasy Shadow Ops series consists of Control Point, Fortress Frontier, and Breach Zone, a standalone prequel in the same universe, but it is not necessary to have read any of my other books to enjoy it. It's called Gemini Cell. It has just come out and is wherever fine books are sold. My work is often described as Black Hawk Down meets the X-Men. I like to say if Harry Potter had joined the Navy SEALs instead of going to Hogwarts. That gives you a good picture of the kind of stuff I write. I'm a military guy, law enforcement guy, intelligence guy from way back.
And I have read, I haven't read your most recent book, but I've bought it, and that's all that really counts.
That's what really matters, yes. Thank you so much for that.
You're welcome. I have read the other three, and I like them very much.
Thanks.
So good job on that.
Thank you.
Even though I gave you a hard time with the title many moons ago. There's so many words. Shadow,
yes.
Op, control point.
Yes, shadow, control, ops, point, yes.
I'm a simple man. I like one-word titles.
I will endeavor for future series.
So you're getting closer.
Actually, it's funny you should mention this, because when I first wrote the trilogy, I entitled them Latent, Riven, and Union, and my publisher nixed it. But that's what they would have been called.
See, that I would have been on board with that. Mm. But I'm no marketing guru. Mm. And my own podcast has a two-word title, so I guess there you go.
There you go.
I just could have named it Random, I guess. But that wouldn't have been as great, probably. Not good with the SEO. Maybe that's what you're publishing.
But it would have resonated with what many podcasts are.
It's true. It would have opened up the things we could talk about.
That's right.
It's so tightly constrained.
That's right.
But so we're here to talk about Star Trek, obviously. Yep. Would you consider yourself a Star Trek fan?
This is the thing, is that I feel like the human brain is a hard disk which has limited space on it, and you can only have so many fandoms. Like when you're building a character, you play D&D.
I do.
You only have a certain number of proficiency points you can allocate. You know, that's why not everybody can be a fighter, magic user, thief, cleric. You can tell I'm from the first edition camp.
I was going to say, this is old school.
Right. You only have a limited number of fandoms, and I spent all my proficiency points on historical wargaming, superhero comics, ElfQuest, early D&D, and fantasy novels, and didn't have enough left over for Doctor Who or for – but this is the thing, is that I've watched a lot of Star Trek. Because you can't exist in a world that has science fiction and being related to it in any way without watching it. So the thing is, I wouldn't consider myself a Trekkie. Like, I don't have, you know, the uniform in my closet. I don't have a rubber hood I can put on and make myself look like a Klingon. But I do. It's almost like my relationship with football. Like, I'm not a football fan. I don't have a team I follow. But I can go to a party and sit down and, like, I know what downs are and I know, you know, what happens when a quarterback gets sacked. So does that sort of qualify halfway?
Well, you know, as I often say, I'm not here to judge anyone's fandom. So I think that qualifies as, you know, you're a casual Star Trek fan.
That's right. I'm a casual Star Trek fan. I'll take it.
And this makes me think that football fans are just doing cosplay in a different way with their jerseys and whatnot.
You know, my attitude with football is, if you're going to put 22 guys on a field, cover them in armor. Just give them spears and let them kill each other. It's more honest.
That's true. I'm all for that. I would watch that.
Me too.
Dial it up on pay-per-view. Yeah. There's probably a Star Trek episode that features that very thing happening. Anyway,
now,
if you were not a fan, well, you're a casual fan, but are you casual enough or so casual that you can't even pick a favorite series?
No, I can totally pick a favorite
series.
There
you go.
It would be the series that we were watching, which is The Next Generation. And that's because my best friend, Peter V. Brett, who's also a fantasy novelist, if your listeners haven't checked out his Demon Cycle series, I can't recommend it enough. He is the biggest influence I have and one of my favorite writers. And I would say that even if we were not friends, it really has to do with the strength of his craft. But he was one of the few guys in college that had a TV, and he used to entertain. He used to have the TV running in his room and Trek. And when Next Generation came on, we used to all gather and watch it together. So it definitely has a special place in my heart that classic doesn't, and that Deep Space Nine or Babylon 5 doesn't.
Of course, Babylon 5, not Star Trek, but that's all right.
I'm showing my...
This call is over. I'm sorry. We can't progress. So now I know your background a little bit. You have a military background. And I have been watching. I do not have a military background. I very nearly, this is not, relevant to anything, but I'm going to tell the story anyway. When I was graduating high school, I was thinking about, what am I going to do with my life? As many people do at that time. And so it was either go to college, right? Or do something else. And I thought briefly, well, maybe I'll go to one of the military academies. They'll whip me into shape. I can help my country. This is great. So I went to a little fair, a career fair, and I think I went up to the Naval Academy guys. Now, and here's another thing. This is going to shock people. As a host of a Star Trek podcast, I am not the fittest person in the world, and I have never really been super fit. So when I was in high school, not the fittest guy. So I walked up to these guys, and I was like, hey, I'm interested in the Naval Academy. What do you think? And they proceeded to make fun of me and tell me that I was not nearly in shape enough. And then I was like, okay, I'm never going to join the military. Thanks a lot, guys. And then I went to college.
I'm really sorry that happened to you. That is awful and unacceptable. And if I had gotten wind of that during my time as a lieutenant, I would have dragged those guys out to the woodshed and made sure they understood that they're not to represent the United States Navy like that to any prospective candidate. I'm really sorry that happened to you. You should not have been made fun of. You should have been encouraged. And the fact of the matter is, if you had come to the academy not in shape, what would have happened is that they would have given you an exercise program before you showed up to try to meet goals so that when you got there, it would be easier on you, and they would have gotten you in shape. And some of that would have been hard on you, but a lot of it would have been encouraging too. And being made fun of is totally unsat, and that should not have happened. I'm really sorry.
That's all right. I didn't bring it up so that you would apologize and stand as the Navy, but...
I mean, look, this is the kind of stuff, this is why nobody ever invites me to parties, because I take it seriously.
No, I appreciate it. I appreciate
it. I'm sorry we lost you, Scott.
I could have been like a captain of something or other.
Yeah, well, this is the thing that I kept noticing during this episode, and we'll get to this, but like so much of the way the commands they give on the bridge, it's just like my experience in the Coast Guard. I was, as a lieutenant, people would have been calling me Mr. Cole and, set a course for aye aye, sir, and very well. Like all of that language, all of that nautical language that you see on the bridge of the Enterprise is
right on, man. That's why I brought up that whole story, because I've been watching a lot of Star Trek for this podcast, obviously, and I've generally been watching Star Trek all my life as a fan, but not with a critical eye, right? So now I'm watching it and thinking about it because, these people are members of this military organization. Starfleet is a military organization, right? And I think to myself often as I'm watching, not that I have any military experience, but I think, I'm not sure if this is how anything would happen in an actual military operation.
It is very, very spot on. It is surprisingly good. And one of the things that I love about Star Trek is how sympathetic it is to the humanity that pervades even extremely bureaucratic and structured organizations like the military. People are people. It's funny. I worked for the CIA for a while, and I was amazed at the public perception of the CIA as this mystique that surrounded it, right? Because it's the CIA. Ooh.
That's true.
And the reality of – I mean, it is – and it does do amazing things, and there is some mystique to what it does. But in the end, the CIA is a bunch of people in a building trying to get something done, and people are people – any way you slice them, no matter how much training they've had, they're people. They're screw ups and they're mavericks and they fall in love and they get in fights and they have bad days and good days, and a lot of people, especially the media, when they portray the military, they portray it as an organization that's sort of immune to that, and it ain't. It's just not the way it is. And I loved the sort of, especially in this episode, I love the sort of casual banter, like when Riker and Picard are in the elevator. And, he's mothering him, mm-hmm. Cluck, cluck, number one. I thought that was really great. And it's exactly the kind of crap that goes on. I've had COs when I've been freaking out about them, who've turned to me and been like, Lieutenant, Mr. Cole, yes, sir, you need to chill. Chilling eyes, sir.
Well, see there. Well, that's good to know. But so my main question, though, is Wesley Crusher, really. Will Wheaton. Of course, we all love Will Wheaton.
Everybody loves Will Wheaton. You can't be on the internet. If you don't love Will Wheaton, you get kicked off.
That's right. But Will Wheaton is not Wesley Crusher. And people have a complicated relationship with Wesley Crusher. But my question, though, to you is, in the season we're watching, the episode we're watching, which is, I guess I can tell people, I always assume it's like a surprise, but it's not a surprise because it's the title of the podcast, Loud as a Whisper, second season, episode 5. So in this season, Wesley Crusher is not even an ensign. He's an acting ensign. He's not even in Starfleet. He's had no training whatsoever.
Yep.
And he is piloting the ship.
He's conning. He's not conning. He's a helmsman.
Yes.
A conning officer is relaying commands to him. Yes, it is 100% realistic. When I was the lieutenant in charge of the reserves at U.S. Coast Guard Station, New York, we would bring our gunboats out, the 25-foot Defender class patrol boats, which are, you know, these are worth a lot of money, and they have guns on them. Like, they're not. This is not a small thing.
That's true.
And we would have cadets come down from Coast Guard Academy to spend the summer with us to be trained. And one of the things they had to do before they went back to the academy was get certified as boat crewmen or as boarding team members. These are the junior certifications. The more senior certifications are coxswain, and which is the senior position for the search and rescue and boat piloting piece, and then boarding officer, which is the senior piece for the gun, you know, the gun carrying and law enforcement piece. So, but yes, we absolutely had these cadets who were basically straight out of high school, right? Piloting, conning, and at the helm of these boats, these incredibly expensive, incredibly powerful boats. They were under tight supervision. You know, we weren't going to let them crash and make horrible mistakes, but
you just go down to the galley or whatever and say, yeah, you kids, I need a sandwich.
Yeah, we don't do that. No, they absolutely, it's the only way they're going to become officers. It's the only way they're going to become leaders. So, no, it was Wesley's position on that ship is totally realistic.
Well, see there, you have made me appreciate Star Trek even more and also made me afraid that all these military vessels are being piloted by cadets. But so it's a good and bad.
Well, you know, cadets under tight supervision.
That's right. That's good. Under highly trained supervision
right.
of people who have spent many years and know what to do and are ready to leap in.
I mean, look at it this way. When you were 16 and getting your learner's permit and learning to drive, sooner or later, someone had to let you, as an unlicensed, essentially a kid, behind the wheel of 3,000 pounds of potential, and you had to be able to go on a highway, right, around other people, including cars with people with their kids, you know.
Well, here's another little story that is not relevant only – well, it's relevant right now because we're talking about driver's licenses. I got my learner's permit the day I got it. I was very excited. Went with my mother, took the car. She took me to a parking lot. I was driving around the parking lot. As an inexperienced driver does, I got a little flustered because my mother was yelling at me. And I may have momentarily forgotten which was the brake and which was the gas. And so I sped up when my mother told me to stop. I didn't hit anything because I was in an empty parking lot. And that was my first and last driving lesson. And I do not have a driver's license.
Really?
It is true.
Scott! You gotta fix that, man.
I live in an urban area. I don't really need a driver's license.
You know, I live in an urban area, and I don't own a car. I mean, I live in New York City, so. But it's not from the your need to drive. It's just the not letting things in life beat you. Like, I mean,
you haven't met my mother. She will beat
your
you.
Mother, you know, forget your mother. Like, you do it just to do it. You know?
It's true. I have no need for it at the moment. But perhaps my wife does also agree that I should get a driver's license. So
I'm with her. What do you use for ID?
I have a state-issued ID.
Wow.
And see, it's a different world. I'm an intriguing man.
Maybe learn on a motorcycle or something cool.
Oh, that seems even more terrifying.
It's so terrifying.
I don't need a motorcycle. But people have learned so much about me today. This is exciting. And I've learned so much about how the military uses cadets to pilot things.
That's right. That's exciting.
Exactly right. So Wesley Crusher, I've had all these years, I thought he has no business being on the bridge. But in fact, it's highly accurate.
It is highly accurate.
Now, he also, in many episodes, experiments on the warp core. Now, do you let cadets, experiment on the nuclear engine and things?
I mean, yeah. Because I told you about certifications.
I guess that makes sense.
Boat crew member and boarding team member, right? Well, there's also engineer certifications. So you get certified as an engineer for both our 25-foot and 45-foot platforms. And this is just at the boat station where I work.
Right.
So that, how do you get certified as an engineer? By engineering. You have to go mess with the engines. Right. So Wesley Crusher, as part of his cadet training or internship, if one of the requirements was that he would have to certify on warp core engineering, he would definitely be down there messing with it. Yes. Under supervision, of course.
Well, that's right. Geordi is never too far away.
So the way this works is that you're given a sign-off sheet. And the sign-off sheet has a number of tasks of increasing levels of complexity that show competence in your particular discipline. So, for example, if you're doing the boarding team member sign-off, your easy early ones might be reciting firearm safety rules or memorizing and reciting back maritime law. And the harder tasks might be, you know, for example, transit in 3-foot swells from the deck of your 25-foot patrol boat to a vessel that you're boarding. So it's a physical skill, right? You've got to show that you can safely move in choppy seas from your boat to another boat without falling in the drink.
I had no idea. This is it's a learning experience
for me. Yeah, I mean, this is things that, and the thing that's funny is if you have military listeners in your audience, everyone's probably rolling their eyes right now being like, yeah, we know this, right? It's just the way it's in every military service.
Well, I apologize to those listeners. But it's interesting to me, so too bad it's my podcast. But we should probably also segue. Wesley Crusher has a very small part in this episode.
He does.
In that he taps a couple things. He may say one thing. I don't even know if he says anything.
He has some lines. Yeah, he's talking about – he says I, like he's piloting the ship. Or
he responds. But this episode is really about Riva.
Yes. Or Riva. Howie Seago.
Yes. He is this dude. So the high-level summary is the Enterprise has to pick up this negotiator, bring him to this planet that's had 15 centuries of warfare, and this negotiator is going to come and settle it down, hopefully. And the negotiator has been, I guess, hired by the warring factions with the
– Requested.
Yes. And the Federation doesn't want to get involved, so they're just, you know, bringing him basically as a goodwill gesture. And then they're going to drop him off, I guess, and leave. Is the plan, I suppose.
Right.
But of course, you know, hijinks ensue because that would be a very brief episode. They pick him up, they take him there, they drop him off, and they say peace out, and they're gone. Now, here's the other thing. There's something interesting about Riva. The opening shows they are arriving at the planet. They, you know, Captain Picard is like, okay, I have to beam down so that we can greet this negotiator. And I'll take Worf and Troy with me. And Riker's like, well, I'm a little – I don't know if you should go. It's an away mission. It might be dangerous. And this leads to that great exchange that you talked about where they're in the turbo lift and Picard is like, cluck, cluck, cluck. You're being a mother hen, Riker.
Yeah.
Which was great. And so they beam down, and this is where they find out Riva is deaf. And he talks with a chorus of three people who sense his emotions and what he means and translate. And this makes me think that Starfleet has very poor intelligence because this is a shock to Captain Picard. But that seems like it would be a high-level item in his profile.
Right.
Deaf has three people talk for him.
Right.
Could be useful information. And this is when we find out that Riva is not only has a giant ego – and three people who talk for him, but is also kind of creepy.
Well, he is kind of creepy, and there's a lot of really bad precedent set in this episode, and I hope we'll get to that later. But I do want to point out, while you're recapping here, that this chorus, mm-hmm. three people, they actually have roles and names.
They do.
And that one of them represents Riga's logic and scientific side, mm-hmm. one of them represents his passion and libido, yes. and one of them represents the harmony between those two sides.
Yes, and they all wear white, I guess, so that they will yes. blend into the background, which I think this is a fascinating idea.
It really is brilliant.
And you know, they say, oh, well, his whole family has some genetic defect. Well, he explains this because it's
His race. It's his planet.
Oh, was it his whole race? I thought it was just his family.
They can't interpret audio signal.
Ah, well, there you go.
None of them can – they the implication is that they communicate the same way that Troy does, through empathy.
Right, to each other. And then they get – I guess he – since he is talking to other people, he needs to have these three folks that he can – talk to empathetically or telepathically, and they will translate for him.
Right.
And they're dressed all in white, so they fade back into the background because there is this nice exchange where Reva appears first, and he doesn't talk to anyone because he can't speak. Well, he can speak, but one assumes he cannot vocalize.
He can read lips. He also can't hear.
That's right. He can't hear. And so they're like, you know, hey, what's going on? And
maybe that he can't hear because of all that hair over his ears.
He does have an impressive hairdo.
This guy puts John Kerry to shame. I mean, like, I have never seen – it's like he's wearing a helmet. I've never seen anything quite like this.
And he has a full beard too, yeah. So –
it's really
– he has quite – he's. It's like he has a mane.
The episode is worth seeing for that alone.
It is impressive, and it gives him quite a distinctive look,
yep.
Which none of his chorus members can quite replicate. Yep. And so he – you know, they don't – they figure out he's deaf, and then they come and the chorus people come in and speak for him and explain the whole spiel. And so, you know, kind of rightfully, your first instinct – if this you're talking to someone and they're talking through another person who's vocalizing what this person's saying, your instinct is to look at the person who's actually talking and
right,
talk to them.
He gets all pissed off about it. He really is a like from the beginning.
He is
a total and that is like our first introduction to him.
You know? Well, not only is he
he's supposed to be this negotiator who's like empathic and is going to make people feel uncomfortable.
Yes.
And for the first moment, I'm like, wow, man, I want to strangle this dude.
Yeah, he yells at Captain Picard, which is never cool. And then, so we find out, like Mike said, that, you know, each of his little people represent a particular aspect of his personality. So one's intellect, one's harmony, and one is basically lust / warrior kind of thing.
Which is just so gross.
It is super gross.
And what your listeners don't know is that all three of them are wearing white, but the lust warrior is the sort of young muscular man, and his armor and his white clothing is almost like it looks like ancient Roman armor a little bit, gladiator armor. Mm-hmm. The science guy has this sort of demasculating outfit that makes him look like an accountant or some, you know, like medieval trader.
With a strange little hat.
And Harmony is this sort of super gracious woman in this, I mean, I guess high-waisted maternity dress, for lack of a better term. But it's all just off. It's all off.
Yeah, it's not good. And it's so I say he's creepy because his interactions with Troy
immediately walks over to this woman who's the one woman I think is in the whole episode is the only except for Harmony, I guess.
Right.
And immediately is like, well, you know, I can. I'm very excited to meet you, and exactly. I'm looking forward to communing with you emotionally. And
speaking through his lust warrior.
And it's so greasy, nasty, like thrown out of a convention for behaving that way. And then he has this sort of shellacked hair and this gross beard. But Troy responds. Yes. And like, yes, I feel the same way. And I'm just watching this from a 2014 sensibility with my skin crawling off my body, thinking this is just setting all the wrong example.
Yeah, it's always interesting to watch shows. I mean, in The Next Generation, this episode premiered, 1989? So that's not that long ago. But it is from a different era. It's much like you watch the original series and you think, whoa, this is super sexist. But at the time, very progressive.
Yeah, but I mean, I also want to diffuse that argument. This is a thing you get when you talk about H.P. Lovecraft, who's just this horrible racist xenophobe. And people are like, well, he was a product of his time. And it really doesn't excuse it. And the reality of it is that plenty of people in that time were not like that.
Do not emulate Reva in any interaction.
Not a good example. But the thing that's so awful is that when you look at it in the episode, you know that the writers of the episode are trying to convey that, like, this guy is such an emotionally sensitive and available person that he just sweeps this woman off her feet when all you really see on the surface is just a grease ball.
And I find this weird, too. I find it a strange way to set him up because they set him up, A, he does this with Troy and is super creepy. And also the lust warrior guy is kind of creepy looking, just standing there.
He's got a mullet.
He does. I'm sure he's a lovely man, but in the getup and the situation, creepy. And then, so he's a negotiator. He's the best negotiator ever. And his first interaction, he's yelling at Captain Picard for doing something that probably everyone who meets him for the first time does. It's very strange. I don't understand why the writer would set it up this way, unless they didn't want us to like Reva, which makes no sense. But not a fan of Reva.
No, not at all, from the beginning.
No, he's but apparently he's very good at what he does.
Yes, and I do want to now comment on the choice of Howie Seago as the actor, though, is that this episode is such a Gemini of both positive and negative. So we talked about the creepiness and whatever. But the thing is that Howie Seago really is deaf and really is an ASL instructor. And one of the things this episode is doing very well from the very beginning is putting disability and dealing with disability front and center mm-hmm. in media. Which is something that TV shows don't often do. So, like, it's a really great show. And Howie Seago's selection as the actor that plays Reva is even better, you know, because they've actually chosen someone who's deaf and uses sign language to communicate to play this guy who's deaf and has this, you know, potential barrier to being a great mediator.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. And apparently he, according to Memory Alpha, my place where I go for all my Star Trek information, the article on this episode says that he petitioned the producers to make an episode that highlighted someone who was deaf in the 24th century so they could deal with it and see what it was. And they came up with this episode and they thought, hey, we should have him play this person and do it very well. And it's sad that they decided to make the character a jerk for some reason.
A creepy jerk,
it's true. But the idea, I really love the idea of having him talk through the chorus. I think that's fascinating. And I think it's great, the message where later in the episode, spoiler alert, his chorus gets destroyed. And so he has to deal with the fact that he can't communicate effectively with people anymore. Which seems weird because I was thinking to myself, why can't the universal translator translate sign language? But apparently it can't. That's beyond it.
Well, you got Data for that.
That's true. So Data learns all five different sign languages that he can, and he then becomes an interpreter. But it's a whole nice thing.
But then in the end, can I not talk about that?
No, yet? You can't. We are totally nonlinear.
In the end, you know, he goes through all this trouble to learn to be an interpreter, and Reva is set up to pull victory from the jaws of defeat, and he's just like, nah, you guys going back to the ship? I'm going to stand here. I'm going to teach these killers who just killed three people sign language. And oh, by the way, I'm not going to show you any of this. I'm just going to tell you what's happening. And then the next thing, it's Captain's log. We are confident that this creepy asshole who has proven to be a complete disaster from the beginning of these negotiations will get it right this time, despite being down the only three people possibly there. We're confident. We're off to the next thing. And, I feel like the cut to the scene of, those Solari, eating Reeves' intestines.
And wearing his face as a mask.
Yeah, I mean, it was just
yeah, and I was thinking, so he could read lips, Reva can. So that makes me think that he speaks English.
Well, he speaks common or whatever.
Or whatever they speak, right? Which I assume is English. But and the people on this planet that he's going to speak whatever language they speak. So he's not going to be able to read their lips and understand what they're talking about.
Well, but Scott, they speak the international language.
Love.
Well, but this is the thing is when he has his super creepy intimate dinner with Troy.
Oh, man.
And I have some quotes from that dinner. I can feel the ship vibrating through my entire body like a great pulse.
Yes.
That was a good one. And you have to allow it to fill you. He says this to a woman.
He does.
With complete straight face. And Troy, who is impeccably acted by Marina Sirtis with zero emotion whatsoever, you know, it's like, it means a great deal to me too. I almost killed myself during that scene because it would have been a preferable feeling to the incredible discomfort of watching it, but I managed to make it through.
Scenario. So he beams up onto the ship, right? He goes to the bridge to check it out in a very – I found very humorous because there are three of them, right? So there's four people Because his three people, they come out of the turbo lift, and then you can kind of see Captain Picard peeking around because there's so many people he can't get out of the turbo. He's like, excuse me, I need to get onto my bridge. And then Captain Picard's like, well, let me introduce you to my crew. And Reva's like, before you do, I must say it's an honor to be on this vessel.
That's right.
Before you talk, let me just tell you how honored I am to be here.
Touching people's chests.
Yes.
Like, dude, get off me. What are you doing?
And then, yeah.
Touching me.
As he's introduced, he weirdly touches everybody. I don't understand why.
They love it. They love it. And that whole interaction with LaForge, mm-hmm. where they're talking about their disability. I'm like, no.
And that's weird too, because so in that interaction, LaForge is like, well, they both agree that their disabilities make them special and that they are happy with who they are because it's part of them and it makes them the person that they are, which I agree with. It's great. That's fantastic message, right? But then they immediately undercut it by LaForge going down to talk to Dr. Pulaski and see if he can get some eyes.
Yes, that's exactly right. And but I do want to underpin that original message, which was absolutely fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the greatest things about this episode. But yeah, they definitely gutted that.
Yeah, I think it is as creepy as it is with Reva hovering his hands over everybody, that interchange with Geordi is great. And also at the end of the episode, Reva talks about the secret to negotiation is turning a disadvantage into an advantage, which I think is a good lesson for people to learn
in general. And I actually wrote that down as a quote. I think it's absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. But I do want to – my original point with this creepy dinner with Troy is that, remember, he sends his translating libido away.
Yes. Well, so that was before you get – he says, oh, I'm very tired, right? And Captain Picard's like, well, we have a room for you. So he has his creepy libido person say, oh, I think Counselor Troy and I are going to have dinner. Wink. And then so they go off. Actually, he says, oh, I think Counselor Troy can show me to my room.
Yeah. And Picard and Riker just stand there instead of being like, no, she's not going to do that.
Maybe Worf should go with you.
Yeah, you're going to go to your room by yourself.
And then he leaves his intellect and Harmony there. And Captain Picard's like, don't you need to go with him? And Harmony says, well, in times like these, we find that we are more of a hindrance. And I was like, whoa, creepy. Super creepy.
So me, Troy, and my are going to go for a walk, you know, and I'm going to leave my reason and Harmony here on the bridge. It'll just be me, her, and my great. No, this is not happening. This is a terrible idea. You know, you go to your room by yourself.
Yeah, or with your chorus.
Or with your three, like, enablers, facilitators.
Because you also have to think, I imagine, Reva. Well, maybe when he's on his planet, he could talk to everybody, so he doesn't need to have his chorus around. But they've been around forever, so he might feel a little lost without them. But then we get into this dinner, which happens after this briefing, where Reva continues to be super jerky. and he's like, I don't even need this briefing.
I've just wasted all your time.
And I was like, couldn't you like have sent a cancellation before everybody gathered? But he doesn't. And then he goes off to have his creepy meal with Troy. So I just wanted to paint the picture of all the creepy and weird things he does before then, which really undercut his reputation as the best negotiator ever.
Yeah.
And then he talks about throbbing ships and sends
filling Troy.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
And says, has this weird thing where he sends off his lust warrior person, who's his interpreter, right? And then he kind of forces Troy, so he can read lips, so he understands what Troy's saying. And Troy has to figure out, based on his hand signals, what he's saying.
Right, but what the episode is clearly trying to convey is that they're speaking the language of emotion and empathy.
That's right.
They're just communicating without language, and isn't that beautiful?
You don't need these barriers, these artificial boundaries.
Right. And this is apparently what he's going to use with the Solari at the end of the show, when he sends everybody off and stands there awaiting his own evisceration.
Which I see, you know, so the Solari have been fighting for 1,500 years. There's a lot of deep, troubling things between these people, I imagine.
Oh, and during the briefing, he's like, what's changed? What's changed?
Yes.
He's been fighting 1,500 years. And I was watching that thinking, oh, yeah, like, that's a really good point.
It is a good point.
And it's never answered.
Yeah, we're like, Data's like, I don't know.
Yeah, everyone's like, I don't know. And apparently the showrunner's like, well, forget about it. It doesn't matter.
We you don't know either.
What changed? They want to make peace.
They decide. That's what Riker's like. Well, they want to make peace. So
can I just point out that the Solari, like the Klingons, like mm-hmm. the Ferengi, mm-hmm. like the Vulcans, like what are the bad Vulcans again?
Romulans.
The Romulans. Every Star Trek alien is a person with a prosthesis on their head.
Yes.
I just want a Star Trek alien that looks different from a person. Like, you know, it's a Vulcan, which is a guy with like a fish's back on his forehead. It's a Ferengi, which is a guy with elephantitis of the forehead. And the Solaris are guys with mm-hmm. elephantitis of the forehead and like the jaw a little bit. You know, like. You know, they just put them in a different costume, mess up their forehead. It's always the forehead, and you get a Star Trek alien.
It is true. There is an episode that attempts to explain why that is, and so there was this race of people that are kind of like the default aliens that are just humanoids with no
forehead.
No foreheads, no crazy foreheads, just regular, well, I guess that's a value judgment, just a prototypical forehead. And they went throughout the galaxy seeding their DNA onto different planets. And then all the races kind of came from that.
And all the races had forehead mutations, but otherwise remained exactly the same.
Exactly, as evolution has taught us.
Right.
So it's perfectly reasonable.
It's all in the forehead.
And also... they have a budget, so it's probably super easy to just put some makeup on someone's forehead and say, hey, look, we have aliens. Which I think might be. As I'm watching Star Trek, I think that there are a lot of decisions are influenced by budgets.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they are this race. We don't really learn much about them, except that they are angry with each other. There's a traitor that kills the chorus. With a cool kind of disruptor beam that burns away their flesh and then melts their skeleton in kind of a cool effect, I thought.
Yeah, that was a cool effect.
And then he gets killed. But then that made me think, they beam down Reva and his chorus to this place that Reva chooses. They send Riker and Worf to go with him as security. And on a planet where warfare has been happening for 1,500 years, you think they'd send a couple more people down.
Yeah.
Just to make sure, you know,
yep.
To make sure nothing happens. And Worf proves quite ineffectual. Riker kind of tackles Reva as this traitor goes to shoot and kill Reva because he doesn't want the peace to happen. And he misses, obviously, and kills the chorus. Worf doesn't do anything, and then they beam back up.
Right.
So it seems like maybe Worf should have been paying a little more attention.
I think so.
But sadly, not.
Also, Worf at the beginning is angry with Reva because Reva, the Klingons didn't have the word peacemaker until Reva. He was negotiated the earliest peace treaties among the warlike Klingons. And you think that that's a threat that the story will pull, Worf's relationship with mm-hmm. And, of course, nothing happens with that, too. They just let that plot line drop.
Nope. And then also another plot line that is meaningless but has a cool little holographic projection from Picard's desk as we open.
He's studying.
He's studying this system that has a weird orbit. A planet has a weird orbit in the system. And he has a little conversation with Riker about it. And you think, oh, maybe this will have something to do with the episode.
I almost wonder if they seed these plot lines because they intend to, if they're literally deliberately leaving loose threads because they don't know when the season's going to end. It's going to be an ongoing series and they want to, and then they write them down in the writer's room. And then like when they're like, okay, we need to come up with episode 12, you know, what loose threads do we have? We can pull this one or this one.
That is a possibility. I also think maybe they just throw a bunch of stuff on the wall and say, let's just put it in. It sounds kind of cool. It'll let us project a hologram on Picard's desk, and that's cool.
Maybe so.
But it also ends. The episode ends with him looking at the same thing with no resolution whatsoever. But he just keeps looking at it. He just likes to look at his little model of that solar system.
You can blame him. We all have our, you know, some of us like to paint toy soldiers. What are you going to do?
That's right. He drinks tea and looks at this model of solar system. He's a good captain, so who am I?
Right.
That is – the episode has some troubling themes, but some very good themes overall. Reva is very – so here's – I was watching this episode with my wife, and when they pick the spot to do the negotiations, Reva says, oh, it's important for us to set it up correctly. And then
the setup has nothing to do with it.
Right, the setup has nothing to do with it. And the people doing the Goshens come like 2 seconds later before they even set anything up, which was odd. But the setup includes a triangular table, which I guess there are three people, three sides, so that makes sense, and two torches.
Right. Torches are very important in Salari negotiations.
Apparently, and they are. In fact,
the 1,500 years of warfare that have been rocking this poor planet for its history are due to a original negotiation where instead of the ritual torches, somebody brought a flashlight.
That's what's changed. They have decided that torches are stupid, and so now they can have negotiations again. The particular torches that they beam down, Worf has to turn them on, and to turn them on, you push a button on the back, which I thought was kind of cool. But my wife said, aren't they in the future? Don't you think they would be evolved beyond fire torches? And I thought, well, that's a good point. But
well, apparently, certain societies prioritize different things. Well, what are you going to do?
It's true. These people put all their effort into making cool disruptor pistols and left the finer points of lighting by the wayside.
That's right.
But they love triangular tables as well.
They do.
And so it ends, as you said, it ends with Reva just standing
awaiting
there.
Awaiting his certain death.
Yes, because no one will be able to understand what he's saying.
Right. Be like, screw this, they're going to kill him. Although the idea is that he is going to teach them sign language. Right. And that in learning to communicate, they're going to learn to communicate. They're going to learn to bridge the differences with each other. And some of this is – I think that the whole creepy dinner with Troy, if you were to put a gun to the writers' heads and say, explain to me what the hell you were thinking.
Why?
Yeah, that they would tell you that they were trying to set up the idea that empathy – and the ability to communicate without words through empathy, mm-hmm. Was really what Reva was setting up there. And that after losing his chorus and being sort of disarmed and disabled and by that, and having no ability to mediate, he realized that he had it within him all along.
That's right. With the help of Troy.
And turning this disadvantage to an advantage. Right. This disadvantage of not having a way to communicate, mm-hmm. the advantage of you can communicate even better with empathy without words. And that's what he's going to use to conclude this negotiation.
That's right. And we skip over one minor plot point in that. So Reva, his chorus is destroyed. He is rightfully kind of shaken by this and decides he cannot do it. He can't do the negotiations. And so they're like, well, we'll just send Troy down there.
Yeah, we'll just send Troy, even though she has zero experience.
Well, she's never done this before. They requested the best negotiator in the galaxy, but we'll give them someone.
And by the way, they have proven themselves willing to kill whoever's down there.
That's right. So we'll send Troy down there.
You're willing to send Troy off on a nice walk with this guy in his in the hallway. We're going to send her down to certain death.
Exactly.
One could be forgiven for believing that the writers of Star Trek The Next Generation, at least around the time of this episode, maybe didn't have the highest opinion of women, or at least the highest opinion of Troy.
Yes. And then so, but there's a nice scene in which she says to Reva, she's like, I have to do this. I've never done this before. Unlike you, I'm not a quitter, so I'll go do it. She doesn't say that quite, but she gets to that point.
Well, she says that.
And she's like, well, give me some advice. And this is where he has that great advice where you turn a disadvantage into your advantage. And she says, why can't you do that? And the light opens. And he realizes the error of his ways, and he decides that he will force them to learn sign language.
Look, this is the thing about this episode, and I've said this before. It was so conflicted for me watching it in that it was both a beautiful and brilliant and brave approach to disability, which is a thing that is not dealt with in science fiction and fantasy nearly enough, and nearly enough sympathetically. And in that regard, it was a brilliant, brilliant episode.
Yes. When I was remembering this episode, I remembered the positive message, and I completely forgot the whole creepy,
stuff. Probably originally watched this episode as, a young kid in adolescent, right?
That is true.
Right. So, when you're all hormones and you're also not very intellectually developed, you don't get it. I remember when I was that age, I didn't have as developed an understanding of what my responsibilities toward other people were. You get older and you mature.
That's true. So kids, don't be like Reva. That's
please,
the lesson.
Dear God, don't be like
Reva. In some situations, you can be like Reva. In situations involving the opposite sex, don't be like Reva. And probably be a little nicer than he is in general.
And for the love of God, get a haircut.
Damn hippies. Next on Random Trek, Deep Space Nine's Season 6 premiere, A Time to Stand.